Good afternoon, folks. It's time for the Elephant in the Room on WJAS 1320 AM and 99.1 FM Talk. This is your host, Sam DeMarco, and I'm joined in studio as usual by my trusty executive director, John Schneider, and our producer, dazzling dandy, Daryl Grandy, the man who makes all the magic happen. And folks, you can tell I'm a little bit excited, and that's because I'm looking forward to a long earned rest because our big dinner, our 122nd annual Lincoln Day dinner that the Republican Committee of Allegheny County holds, was a rousing success on Thursday night. We had almost 450 people there to hear from many of our great candidates, our speakers. We heard from U.S. Senate candidate, the next U.S. Senator from the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania, Dave McCormick. We heard from our Keystone speaker, Senator John Barrasso from Wyoming, who also, ironically, is a Pennsylvania native, having been born in Reading on the other side of the state in Berks County. We heard from Treasurer Stacey Garrity. We heard from State Senator Devlin Robinson. And we were State Representative Rob McCurry. And we were very pleased to be able to honor a couple staunch and stalwart Republicans in Dick Joel, the former president of Grove City College, and Tom Corbett, the former governor of the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania and an Allegheny County resident hailing from Shaler. We also honored our local committees, the City of Pittsburgh GOP committee. They received the award for the Reagan Award for being the best performing committee in the past year. And we also, Aaron Coper, received an award for outstanding grassroots service. And Mike Charlone received another award for the young Republican who's exhibited the most outstanding service to the party as an up-and-comer. So, and we got all of those awards, we got all of those speeches in, we got all of that done by 9:30 last night, which is quite a testament considering that we only ran 2 hours. So I, in my MC duties, was acting like, what was that guy on the Federal Express commercials that talked like the auctioneer? That's how fast I had to get things through to just get it done, you know? But anyway, folks, hey, that's out of the way. I can take a temporary breather here before the real work starts, but that work starts tomorrow. And that's for us to take and save this country. We have a lot of work to do in front of us with the advent of Act 77, mail-in voting, and things of that nature. You know, campaigns no longer start after Labor Day. Campaigns are going to start now. And we're going to have to get involved. And, you know, last night, John, one of the things that was great to see was all of the unity that we saw in the room. I mean, there were folks that didn't always get along together. But last night, they all came together in unity. It seemed like everybody was on the same page. They were enjoying themselves, and they understood what the message was. And that message, folks, for all of our listeners, is you're either part of the solution or you're part of the problem. And by that, I mean we all have to get on the train and start going in the same direction if we want to take and save this country. And as you sit there and you look at who the folks that you're paying attention to, who the folks that claim to be leaders out there in the community, if they spend more of their time complaining about other Republicans, the party, the local committees, all these different things, they're not going to lead you to anywhere but to defeat. Folks, there's no ifs, ands, and buts about it. You know, when you look at the southern border, 12 million illegal immigrants coming across probably before the end of Biden's first term. You have the Democrats in the Senate voting lockstep. Every single one of them is a party to allow these illegal immigrants to be counted in the U.S. Census toward the Electoral College apportionment. You have every single Democrat in the House, and that includes Summer Lee, who it's expected of, but Chris DeLuzio in the 17th District, you know, voting against a bill requiring voters to be U.S. citizens in order to vote. I mean, folks, if that doesn't tell you what they're up to, nothing will. And whether you agree with 100% of the candidates or you don't, or you agree with 100% of their positions or you don't, every single candidate we have on our slate this year is better than their opponents. And if you have any more questions about that, feel free to give me a call at the office at 412-458-0068. And I'll be happy to explain to you why. Now, John, I got that monologue / rant / whatever you want to call it out of the way, right? So now we can get to what really brings us here today. And listeners, this is an important message. This is an important show today. Normally, we talk a lot about politics. We bring candidates in. We let them talk to you about their campaigns and where they stand, their opponents, why they're running, and things of that nature. Today, we're going to do something a little bit different. I've invited a friend of mine and a friend of many of yours, former congressman and former state representative and House member here in Pennsylvania, Tim Murphy, to join us in studio today to talk about a topic that is near and dear to him, and that's mental health. Tim, thank you so much for joining us in studio today.
Sam, great to be with you. Really,
well,
it's great.
Well, it's great to have you here. And listen, when you were in Congress, you did some phenomenal work, and you managed to get, you know, the first ever real mental health bill passed. Do you want to talk to folks a little bit about that?
Sure. This was the first major comprehensive bill. There's been other things that deal with mental health and, mm-hmm. and dribs and drabs and some important legislation too, but I kept seeing those as Band-Aids on a badly bleeding patient and not really taking care of it. What I did was I just looked at what are the major issues that are problems for mental health, and even the question is, what's going on with mental health? Now, May is Mental Health Month. It's not Mental Illness Month. It's Mental Health Month. Think about that. Mental health is basically how you negotiate the everyday stresses of life. And sometimes they get you overwhelmed or stressed out or depressed or anxious or affect our physical health. But mental health is being able to do that. Mental illness is when the system is really hurting. It could be major depression, major anxiety disorders, schizophrenia, psychosis. And what I saw in America, the way that my whole bill started was, this was when the Sandy Hook Elementary School shooting took place. Mm-hmm. And at that time, the majority leader and speaker said, what do we do about this? Now, as you know, every time that comes up, the liberals say it's about guns. Let's ban guns. And I said, it's not what's in their hands, it's what's in their minds that we need to be concerned about. And why aren't we treating these problems ahead of time? Very often they just get passed on, overlooked. The child graduates from high school or drops out of school, and then nobody cares about it anymore because once they're out of the system, they're out. But what we're not looking at is that about half of serious mental illness, like psychosis, schizophrenia, appears by age 14, about 75% of the case by age 25. And what happens with that is, in some cases, when it's really growing, it's getting severe, if that person is not in treatment, they're about 16 times more likely to engage in some sort of violent act. Now, that can start off as something simple. They're in Walmart, they're hallucinating, they're grabbing things, security grabs them, they fight back, or it can be what appears to be an intentional assault or a murder. To about 10% of homicides are believed related to severe mental illness, and about 33% of mass shootings. But my point is, why aren't we taking care of these people? And I found a number of really fascinating things about it. One is, why aren't we offering people hospital beds? The majority of people in the county jail have some sort of mental illness, substance abuse or mental illness. The majority, I think it's 70 or 80% in most county jails, about half in state prisons, penitentiaries, and less than 20% in federal. Now, but you look at that, even such thing as schizophrenia may affect 1% of the population. But it could be 10% of homicides. Something is amiss here. And why aren't they in a hospital bed? And once they're in jail, they get in a fight with a guard or someone else, the charges pile up and they may end up in for months or years. So why don't we have enough hospital beds? Well, back in the 1950s, we had 500,000 psychiatric hospital beds in this country. And I'm sure you're familiar with some of the places around here, Mayview, Dixmont,
Woodville. Yep.
Huge institutions that were built for good reasons when they were built. Back in the 1800s, what we did with the mentally ill is they would end up in jail, in prisons, or abandoned, severely abused in those places. And so what happened is Dorothea Dix went around the country and saying, we need to have more humane places, asylums, sanitariums, whatever it was. And they were calm places with beds and nice grounds, and that was good and helped many people. But they also became a place where anybody could send a relative or friend there and put them away. And then in World War II, what happened is these places were growing by thousands of people in each one. And then they lost their medical staff. They went off to fight in World War II, and so they hired a lot of other people there who started saying, you know, these conditions are pretty awful. Well, this went on then through the 1950s. The places are getting more and more packed, more and more problems occurring. And John Kennedy, when he was president of the United States, the very last bill he signed in October of 1963 was to say, we need to get rid of these big institutions. We need to find other places for them. So this was a community mental health bill. Have these community mental health centers for outpatients. Still sounds like a good idea, except it's not good for everybody. Some people really need that day-to-day significant care wrap around them. Well, as the federal government is pulling their money out, so Kennedy died, Johnson says, we're going to continue with this. We're not going to keep putting federal money. And here's what happened. They said, you know, for Medicare, which is emerging under the Johnson administration, we're not going to pay the bill for any hospital that has more than 16 beds. So you take the local place we talked about, that thousands mm-hmm. of beds, we're not paying for any more than 16 beds. So who's got to pick up the tab on that? The states. States are scratching their head. They're not putting money into it. Then you had another force coming in, the ACLU and other groups, saying, you know what, it's unfair. You're asking these people to shear the sheep and to feed the cows and milk the cows and get the chickens and count the eggs. You're making them work, mow the lawns, and you need to pay them all for this. So as employees, state says that's even more money we don't have. Well, in California, what happens there is the legislature voted to say, we're not going to have these institutions anymore. Reagan signed the bill when he was governor of California. He's blamed for this, but it's not his fault because it really is the legislature and the ACLU with a perfect storm there.
Right.
Okay, so what happens? So fast forward to now, we have about 35, 38,000 psych beds in this country. So what happens if someone is having that severe crisis where they may not know who they are, what they're doing, be hallucinating, delusional, not in medication, not in treatment? People call the police. That's what they do. They're frightened. They call the police. There's a brain disease. Why are you calling the police? Because we worry about violence. And where do the police take them? They may take them to the emergency room. Emergency room says, we don't have beds for this person. Maybe we'll sedate them, keep them here. But if they keep them more than a certain number of hours, 72 hours thing, they have to go to court and force that person into treatment. Well, all that person has to say is, I'm not going to hurt anybody. Okay, you're out of here. And the hospitals have no way of keeping them then. And they said, well, fine, we don't have beds, so go. But the courts are like, they're not really qualified. Courts are not qualified to do a psych diagnosis. So what happens? We end up with people who may go back out, commit a crime, or even in the context of police when talking to someone, harm them. I mean, there's been incidents around Pittsburgh, I don't need to name them, where the police have confronted someone and that person may have lashed out of police and may have been killed in that encounter. Sometimes it's suicide by cops. Sometimes it's like a psychotic person. The other place where these folks have gone, even though the concept was, oh, let's have them all in group homes, that's not suitable for many people. What do? Take a look at the streets. A big percentage of the homeless have a severe mental illness. Again, psychosis, schizophrenia, et cetera. And then on top of that, many of them use drugs. And that makes it even worse. I remember being downtown Pittsburgh a few months ago over at the Mellon Park, that beautiful park across from the William Penn Hotel. And of course, the park is all closed off. And underneath that, in front, were these places that used to be shops, but everything's closed in Pittsburgh now, so many places. And I saw people lying there smoking weed, open bottles, no longer put in a paper bag. Women of the night working actively at that time too. It was disgusting. And there's a police officer there who's directing traffic. And I said, are you allowed to do anything? He said, no, we're not. We're not allowed to do anything. Now, the concern I get is that if these people have drug problems and other things, why aren't we taking care of them?
Well, look, you've identified a couple of things, and I just wanted to touch on it. You talked about the homeless, for example. Yeah, studies have shown that 75% of the homeless are others either suffering from alcohol or drug addiction or mental illness. Mm-hmm. Okay, and then you also talked about one of the big problems here when you brought up a county jail, and I would agree with you 100% that 60 to 70% of the folks in the county jail are suffering from some form of mental illness. But the problem is, like, one, there's no one size fits all solution to this. And then the second thing is, how do whatever tools or solution we do come up with, how do we educate the public so that A, they're able to try to get the folks in their family or their friends the help that they need before having to call the police? Because by the time they call the police, something's going on that folks want it to stop. And that's why the police get involved. And they're not trained mental health counselors.
And you end up with a crisis there. Well, here's the issue. It's tough enough to get someone to get help when they're just dealing day-to-day depression and anxiety. Mm-hmm. I mean, I work with veterans and first responders. That's what I specialize in, deal with trauma. And even have a veteran who all his friends have said, hey, Charlie, you got to get some help, man. You're not sleeping. You're struggling. Your marriage just broke up. You're getting in fights. You can't be doing this anymore. I'm fine. I don't want to deal with this. And that's someone who's pretty coherent and aware. You have other people who say, I don't really want to go see someone. I think I can work my way through this. So they're denial. They delay all these things. So that's tough enough. Now, when you have someone who is severe mental illness, the brain disease where they're hallucinating, they're delusional, they don't even know they're sick. It's called anosognosia. How do you get them help? Very often they won't get help. About half are not in any treatment. And that's why it comes down to, some people call, we're going to coerce them into care, or a court order. I believe some people need that. Now look at the difference. If someone has Alzheimer's and an 80-year-old woman is wandering the streets in January thinking she's got to get to school, they'll take her right to a hospital. Right. They'll call the family. When it's mental illness, if that person says, no, you can't call anybody because the FBI's planted sensors in my brain and they're working with the FBI, they're not allowed to call the family.
Right.
Because of HIPAA confidentiality laws, they do that. So what do we need to do? Well, one is we need to change HIPAA laws so that, in a city the size of Pittsburgh, people know each other. And I mean, I've had clients too where I know the family. And if someone says, oh, no, you can't do this, what do they say? It's better be tried by a jury or peers than see someone carried by six people in a box.
Right.
And even though a person may have been severely delusional, I says, listen, I got to contact your family. Your family wants to know where you are. But still what hospitals do is they may discharge someone and say, bye, and you're on your own. And so what we need to have change HIPAA law so in compassionate communication, a provider, if they know the family, can contact. Second thing is we need more beds. So there's an option of where to go. And nice places, not dumps, not warehouses, but places is nice. You know, you go to some hospitals and you look at some of the units and clinics, they're beautiful. Psych units are locked, pretty stark, pretty barren, and they're understaffed. Half the counties in Pennsylvania don't have a child psychiatrist in. You need them because that's when these problems emerge. We don't have enough providers. So we need more providers. We need more beds. We need these HIPAA laws changed. We need something else involved where sometimes it can be court ordered, the person has to get treatment, but it's outpatient treatment. Now, what stands in the way? Money. How much money? Well, this is fascinating. The White House released a report in 2022, just under 2 years ago. It said the cost of treating mental illness in America is $280 billion. Sounds like a lot of money. It's so far off, the number is junk. And why is it so far off? Because if you look at such things as, let's do costs and costs of lives and costs and money.
Okay.
So let's take the cost in life. Suicide between the years 2000 and 2024, 950,000 deaths. Now, probably the number of suicide attempts is 10 times that amount or 30 times that amount or more. Acute and chronic illness, because somebody who has severe mental illness tend to die 10 to 20 years sooner, which means they've had a lot of chronic illness along the way. That's a big cost, but it's a lot of costs and deaths. Homeless, we don't know how many, it's somewhere between 15 and 40,000 deaths a year. In terms of homicides, 10% of homicides and 33% of mass killings of someone with severe mental illness. People in jail, we don't know how many homicides in jails, how many deaths in jails. We just don't know. But we do know this. If we add up those numbers, the total deaths in just the last 20 years in this country related to mental illness is more deaths than all the deaths from all the combat, all the wars in the United States from 1776 to today. More. Far more than COVID deaths, too, by the way. Mm-hmm. Now, with COVID, we shut down the planet. But with these things, because it's some here and some there, people don't really recognize it. The other thing in terms of cost, that $280 billion the White House said, here's the real numbers. A study on depression that was released, I think, 3 or 4 years ago said it's about the real cost for depression alone is $326 billion. The only study I could find counting the cost of anxiety disorders for the treatment, the problems that go with that was something like 40 some billion, but that 46 billion, but that was a 1990 study. So that amount, even real dollars, is probably three times that amount. The cost of schizophrenia, a study I led a couple years ago, $280 billion per year. And the cost of drug and alcohol problems, about $249 billion for alcohol, $193 billion for drug abuse. Look at those numbers. It's $1 trillion mm-hmm. in a year, $1 trillion a year. And when it comes time for the beds, what happens when I introduce legislation that says, lift this 16-bed limit, let a hospital, you can't hire a psychiatrist and staff for 16 beds in a unit. You can't do that.
Right.
Especially when people need to stay there for probably 3-4 weeks to stabilize their medication.
Yeah, the ROI is not there. It just doesn't work.
Yeah, it doesn't work.
For provider.
But if Medicare is paying for it, it could help out. At that time, they said, well, it's going to cost us $1.2 billion a year. Now, listen to what I just said. $1 trillion a year, but we're not going to spend $1.2 billion a year. And that froze that part of the bill because you have to have an offset. At the time, Paul Ryan was the speaker and we had other people. I said, surely there's somewhere where you can find $1 billion in this government. No, you can't. So that part was pulled from the bill. The HIPAA part was pulled from the bill because liberals are saying, oh no, you should never, ever, ever go around someone and share information. I said, but what if you know the family members? What if you know this person is hallucinating? The suicide, we put a lot of money into suicide issues in this country, but it dabbles around. Very important things have done with great suicide hotline now. Those are important. It saves a lot of lives. But why are we getting so depressed? What's happening to our nation? The massive increase in depression, anxiety, and teenage and young adults, the huge increase of all these problems, we're not addressing the core issues.
Well, that brings us to why one of my big questions here is, you mentioned the pandemic a little bit earlier.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I wanted to ask you and get your viewpoint on whether you thought the pandemic exacerbated a lot of what we're seeing today as far as mental illness, particularly among our youth.
Absolutely. Unequivocally, absolutely. We took away from youth the thing that is their core structure that they have in everyday life, school. At school, they for many of the kids, whether that was their real meals of the day or their real socialization away from problems, that was important. But even kids who are not living in very distressed environments and low socioeconomic communities, this was where they had a lot of connections. So where do they turn? They turn towards social media. Now, social media, Dr. TikTok and Dr. Google became devastating because every kid began to identify, oh, I must have this. It's amazing the number of kids who self-identified as having anorexia, of having autism. I mean, I've talked to some college professors say, it seems like all the kids in my class are now saying, oh, I have anorexia, I have gender dysphoria, because they go look at all these things and they jump on the symptoms. But a lot of it was also the incredible distress that was out there. We were told, can't go outside, you can't be around people. I mean, I talked to families, a man whose wife was dying in a hospice. He said, I'm 80 years old. Let me sit in the room. No, you can't. Regulations say you can't be there. So they let him, they gave him a chair to sit outside her room and watch her death through the window. He died soon after that himself, a death of despair. We know that was the worst advice. And even CDC and Fauci are now saying, you know what, the masks didn't make a difference. The best thing you could have done was be outside. Sun kills viruses. All this false information, but it devastated our lives. People lost their jobs. So you have all those factors coming through. The stability wasn't there, the loss of jobs, the loss of social interaction, major issues, and we really haven't recovered from that yet. And among students, here's another thing, something like 400,000 kids we've lost. Now, how do we lose them? Kids who are homeless, kids who dropped out of school, we don't monitor where they go. We don't know, as a homeless child may be in three different schools in the same year, but they dropped out. No one has records of these kids. Probably a lot of them went into sex trafficking. We've had huge increase in sex trafficking in this country too, more than all the years of slavery in this country. So there's been a lot of devastating upset there that these forces have come in, and it isn't just talking to someone about your feelings. There's more to it than that. We've eroded a lot of stability in our society, from churches to clubs to organizations there, and then people say, well, turn to government. Government's going to help you. Bad idea. Government is going to help you on this.
What did Reagan say? The worst words in the English language are, I'm from the government and I'm here to help
I'm
you.
I'm here to help you, right.
Right? But no, so we're talking about that. So the pandemic certainly exacerbated this problem, mm-hmm. particularly among our youth. But I also think social media plays a tremendous role. I mean, when you and I, Tim, when we were young and we went to school, they didn't have this social media. So bullies.
When you were young, they had what? Stones and chisels?
Oh, absolutely. I rode a dinosaur to school with no shoes, walked uphill in the snow. I mean, the whole bit. Dinosaur, we've heard it, right?
Yeah.
But hey, you know, when we were bullied or kids were bullied in school when we were there, you know, you had a respite when you were able to go home,
mm-hmm.
you know, the day. Here, these kids can never escape it because with social media, you know, the bullies follow them mm-hmm. and the hate that you see on social media is so terrible. Folks will, I call them keyboard warriors, but they will say things on social media they wouldn't dare say to your face. And, you know, when people like yourself, you know, you're in the public eye.
Mm-hmm.
You're an elected official. I know that you received tons of hate,
sure.
right? I get it all the time. I call it fan mail, okay? But yeah, I developed thick skin. But, you know, we as adults and as folks that are stable, we're able to deal with it. When you have a young, impressionable child, you know, and they're receiving this, they don't know.
They don't know. And there's important issues for that too. We have to remember the brain of youth is not really fully developed till at least age 25.
Mm-hmm.
They're governed by their emotions. A part of the brain called the limbic system is predominant. It's feeling. And in terms of, is that helpful for the survival of the human race? Yeah, you need to be able to react with fight or flight with fear. But our emotions there, the forebrain, which is our intellectual, the planning, the executive function, doesn't really fully develop until 25. So what happens? That's one of the reasons why peer influence is so big. And again, in terms of human beings, to be clustered around each other socially is important, and to respond to the social groups. But where kids have gone is to what you just say, the cyber bullies and others. And some kids, I think it's like 30% say they spend almost all day in contact with social media. They get things sent to them anonymously. You know, you're right. I got them too. And I guess I didn't develop thick enough skin. But what was helpful is if I knew who it was and found out who it was and call them up, hey, you just posted something on your Facebook right. page about me. What do you mean? I know who you are. I'm giving you an opportunity to talk to me. Go ahead, let it fly. They didn't like that. But with youth, it's anonymous, and they feel very often they can't get backing in school. Now schools, with a lot of their social and emotional learning, are putting kids down for speaking the truth about things. They're told they have to follow all these things about gender dysphoria, and I think a lot of that is incredibly
insanity.
False information
yes.
that's out there. And so kids are told to question everything. It's not there. Now, as a Marine, you know, we're both in Department mm-hmm. of Navy.
Yes.
I know. Yeah, go ahead.
I'm in the Men's Department.
Men's Department, yeah.
Yay.
That's right. And you can't walk on water, so you need the Navy, right? So that's
right.
how it works.
That's
so,
right.
yeah, that's what you're supposed to say. So, but with that, what we both understood is a compass. And why is a compass value? Because when you're hiking or where you're sailing, you know of your direction.
Right.
Kids have lost their compass. There is no truth anymore. Everything is subjective. Kids get in trouble for misusing a pronoun, or they may use one day, another one the next. The scores in your math tests don't matter anymore. Kids can use AI to write papers. They can graduate from school without knowing how to read and write properly for their age level. The list goes on and on. And so what do institutions do? Well, we'll just lower the standards or eliminate the standards. The schools will say, we're not going to use SAT tests or ACT tests anymore. We're not going to require the bar exam in the state of Washington anymore. These are do it. Declare yourself something. And without knowing where you're going, there's a great anecdote I love from Alice in Wonderland. She's wandering into the woods. And she comes to a fork in the path. She doesn't know where she is. She's lost in the dark woods. What should appear before her but the Cheshire Cat? You know, this cat with the appears mm-hmm. and a smile and up there. She says, can you help me? Which way do I turn? Where do I go? And he says, well, that depends a great deal on where you want to go. And she says, I don't really know where I'm going. And he said, then any path will take you there. And that's where we are now. There is no real clear path of where we're going. And if people ask questions, as a society now, we're gaslighted. Did you know there really is no inflation right now? There's no problem with the border. There's no crime from these things. The university kids, they just want to blow off a little steam. There is no Antifa. And people are thinking, wait a minute, I know this stuff. If it wasn't for social media, people would not know a lot that's going on. And that's all we want. Tell people the truth. Americans are smart enough. Let them figure this out. Thomas Jefferson knew that. Other people who pushed for the free press and Constitution was that. But over time, you have a media that says, no, we're going to control your flow of information. This has left people anxious. So I'm talking here about the struggle. Back to your full question, why are people more depressed and more anxious that's going on? At the time when their brains are forming and all these things are developing, they're told nothing matters, nothing stable, change moment to moment. And what do they say? They graduate from high school, maybe they live in their parents' basement, says, I don't really know what reality is anymore. That's a tough way to live.
Well, we're going to take a break, but when we do come back after the break, we're going to look to you and ask you on what you think some of the things that we could do to try to make a difference in this area if we want to take and make some changes. Folks, we're taking a break to pay the bills. This is Sam DeMarco, the elephant in the room, on WJAS 1320 AM. Folks, welcome back to the elephant in the room. I'm joined in studio here today, if you're just tuning in, by former congressman and former state senator and mental health professional, Tim Murphy. And Tim, we were talking in the first segment, you were talking about a number of things, your bills and that you passed through Congress and some of the problems that we face here in this country and what you believe some of the factors that are driving the, this, do we call it an epidemic? You know, this onset of just increased mental health issues?
It's grown so much that it is like that now because of the numbers I cited before, the number of deaths and the $1 trillion-a-year cost, mm-hmm. and people are not addressing it directly. They're dabbling around it. A lot of funds are being misused on state levels. A lot of what I quoted before, the $280 billion the federal government says, back when I was doing my bill, I asked the government accounting office, can you give us a number of how much the federal government spends on mental illness? This was in 2015, 2016. And they did. They sent letters out to all the departments. They came back with a number, $130 billion spread over 112 agencies. And I said, well, how much of that is for the care of the mentally ill and how much is administrative costs? They said, we don't know. Well, how about $130 billion? Is that a firm number? We don't know. We just asked departments. They sent us back a letter with a number on it. That's very important. We don't know. So $1 trillion-a-year cost, all these people dying every year, and the federal government has no clue, and the state, no state knows either how much they spend, where it's misspent. Take a local police department. Local police departments say that 20% of their police officers' time is dealing with mental health crisis, mental illness crisis. Well, does anybody count that in the cost? And what do they do about that? Well, it gets worse because policemen see this whole thing is getting worse for their time. Now, where do we go with this? We're called the elephant in the room. So let me talk about one of the elephants in Pennsylvania right now. And that is this big push to legalize recreational marijuana. Now, look, I understand a lot of people have an attitude of, well, why can't I just do this if I want to? All right, I hear you. But my point is, do you understand the dangers that are occurring there? Back in the Woodstock era, marijuana or whatever they were smoking, tea or whatever it was, may have had levels of THC about 2 to 4%. 4% was considered pretty potent.
Right.
Now, it could be 60, 80, or 90%. It is massively potent. And it's bred to have high levels of potency there. Now, what happens is it's big money with big cannabis. And so they push through medical marijuana with the idea that there's certain medical conditions that help with. One of the things they push is it helps with depression, anxiety, sleep disorders. It even helps with morning sickness for women. A number of women posed as pregnant went into cannabis sales clinics, whatever they're called, in California, Colorado, and said, I have morning sickness. What do you recommend? Oh, here, you want to try this. Well, what they were not told is that women who smoke marijuana during pregnancy increase the risk of prematurity, low birth weight, And then, of course, learning problems, behavior problems in their children. It is not recommended. It's counterindicated to, but they say, well, it's going to calm your morning sickness. Well, alcohol can also help you calm down too when you're pregnant, but it's damaging the baby, is developing baby. Here's another thing. They say, well, it helps with depression. Well, it can take the edge off of things like depression, anxiety, but it makes it worse. When you have these high levels of THC, smoking one or two joints or units of this, or bowls, whatever it is, or vaping, already gets your body to the level where it's having extreme reactions to this. Now, when it's having these extreme reactions and you're getting caught up in all these, what is the impact of this? Well, one is, I said, well, what is the cost then to women, to their babies? What's the medical cost of that? People don't know. What about, they also say the thing, well, the teen use of marijuana actually decreased after it was legalized. I don't know where that nonsense came from. That is so totally false. It's actually increased by 245% from 2002 to 2022, this time span when many states have legalized it, and it's gotten worse. Only 34% of teens who actually think there's any harm from marijuana. The other thing, it's fine. I can smoke this all I want. Here's another falsehood. This that said it's good for mental health and reducing depression that claim they make for. And actually among teens, depression and suicide can quadruple using marijuana. Psychosis risk increases for ages 12 to 25 by about 30%. Now, some people say, oh, they were going to be psychotic anyways. No, it's cannabis-induced psychosis, and it's very severe, and you have this number of times, and it's retractable. It's not retractable. It remains there, which means you have someone who has a severe suicide and other problems with that, too. They also say, oh, it's good for state income. Well, here's another issue with that. In the States, and Canada is a great place to study this because it was nationwide, you see increases in emergency room, long-term mental health care, increased health insurance, and all those continue on. So I think in Canada, auto accidents went up 475%, cannabis-related accidents. Not wow. Just alcohol, but alcohol and cannabis or cannabis alone. 90% required ambulance transport, 50% required hospital admission, 22% were admitted to the ICU, compared with only 2% for those not under the influence of alcohol and marijuana. Who pays for this? Well,
we do.
Yeah, we do. Yes, insurance, we do. All the police time, all the ambulance time, yeah. That's where that goes. So when we look at that, that is a cost to the state and the communities. Do you get reimbursed for that? No.
Nope.
And the list goes on and on. So what happens? Are we providing enough education? You can see billboards of, come to our place and buy cannabis there. I don't see any ads saying, here's the dangers. Do not go near this if you're pregnant or intend to get pregnant. Any adolescent, young adult, do not go near this. We need ads to say, here's what it's doing to your developing brain. Remember, the brain's developing up to age 25. Let people know it can lead to cannabis-induced psychosis, which can have permanent effects after a while. It doesn't take many times for this. I think that even someone who just smokes once a week or once a month or so, you have the increased risk. I've been telling this to our state representatives, state senators, and say, look, if the governor says, you either do this or I'm just going to decriminalize it and let people have all they want, raise that question, who's going to pay for it? You've got to take this money. If they say it's going to be $300 or $400, $500 million, if they put that money just into mental health care, it'd be eaten up like that. Can you imagine the county jail? What would happen if you say, you know what, we now will have enough money to make sure that everybody who's in there with a substance abuse disorder or a mental illness will now get full treatment for that? It would be remarkable. If you were able to do this in Allegheny County, the city of Pittsburgh, for the homeless who are out there in the streets, is we will find people who will go out there and help them. It isn't just a blanket and a food card. It isn't just God bless the folks who give them food and the mission help there. That's wonderful. But they need more. But many people write them off. They're homeless. They want to be homeless. Well, if your alternative is to go to jail, if your alternative is to be beaten up, we need to provide these good kinds of care for them. And the care in the schools and the hospital beds. Easily, that money will get eaten up to have more psychiatrists, psychologists. That's a very important issue. So if they're going to do this, put the money towards mental health, not the playgrounds, not the walking around money, not build all these other things. And I know that's a temptation. I was a state legislator too. You want to have that money for communities, but it's badly needed. What happens otherwise? More people in jail, which costs far more than treatment, more crimes, and all that bills. So we're going to pay more and not have the treatment. We have an opportunity to have treatment.
I think the one of the challenges, I believe, when we talk about this is because the problem is so large, is where do you start? you know? And mm-hmm. I know that you and I have had conversations about the county. I've talked to the county manager and try to get numbers as to, you know, in regards to mental health, all of the ways that we touch it, you know, what is our annual cost? And I believe it was estimated to be in excess of $300 million. And that sounds like a lot of money, but when you look at how many people out there require the help and services, it's really not.
So what does that include? What does that $300 million include?
That I had asked was looking at Department of Human Services, mm-hmm. all of the agencies within Human Services that we spend or give money to that take and try to help folks in some way.
That includes children youth services, the child abuse cases, child neglect?
Yes, and much like you said, you know, the challenge that you had in the federal government, you know, you ask for an answer and they say, well, we send things to the departments and they come back and they tell us, right? Mm-hmm. So this is the number that I'm working with, but it's like, there's so many areas. So it's how do we identify which is the most critical or the easiest one to take on from an immediate perspective and then determine from a budgetary perspective what's needed and then to just start to try to gain those funds. Because, you know, it's like they say the squeaky wheel gets the grease.
Mm-hmm.
And having served in government, you know that for every dollar that government hands out, there's a whole host of hands mm-hmm. that are reaching for that dollar, right?
Right. There's not enough money for this. But what I'm saying is that if people look towards saying 100% of those funds that come from legalizing recreational marijuana and medical marijuana, put them into this and not into the coffers. People say, oh, we've got too much tax money. We need roads and things like that done. Put it where related to the cause. But here's the thing. So, so if you go to a doctor and a doctor says, well, I've got some good news and some bad news. What's the bad news? Well, you have multiple spots of cancer. You have some lung cancer, you have a little bit of liver cancer, but you have some skin cancer and I can take care of the skin cancer right now. That's the easiest thing. So we'll just take care of that. We'll just remove this mole from your face. What about my other cancer? Well, we'll wait till you have money for that. That's where things are. The issues are so severe here, Sam. Now, if you really want to look at that number, that $300 million, it probably is three or four times that amount. So if you were going to go to every school district, private and public, and say, how much of your budget is spent on dealing with mental health issues? Your counselors, your principal's time, and things like that. If you ask your teachers, how much of your time is spent just giving counseling there? Coaches, what is it? They'll tell you. Give us a dollar figure. What's that time? How much your police department's time? The county, all the municipalities, all those things. How much of your time? Give us a dollar figure in hours for what that is. How much the county jail costs? Now, again, if people are not getting treatment, does that count as a cost? Well,
well, I can tell you that, you know, they're not getting treated in some of the places like the county jail because we have all these open positions. And I can tell you that in the field that you're talking about, mental health professionals, we are sorely lacking in numbers.
So, okay? You're right.
In the county, we use something called Resolve Crisis Services, Resolve Crisis Centers. So the police, when they get a call, if they believe that it's a mental health issue, can contact the Resolve Crisis Center and ask for help, you know, for a specialist to be able to come out and send to them. But sometimes the delay is hours.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm talking 2-3 hours or longer, you know, if they can come, because they're pulled in so many different directions, right? So I had thought it might have been a budget issue. I had reached out to the director of human services in the county and asked, you know, hey, what's the cost? And I said, I'll put something in the budget. You know, I thought it was a money issue. And she said, Sam, it's not a money issue. She said, we can't spend down the money we have allocated now.
Well, how much do they get
she
paid?
She said, UPMC, who helps to provide it, mm-hmm. she meets with them on a biweekly basis, you know, to try to increase staffing, but it was an issue. So we were even talking about the potential to try to reach out to students, you know, like at the local universities that were studying,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
you know, in this field to try to engage them in some way, in terms of whatever it may be, you know, to try to increase the staffing. But so you have staffing issues as well.
But then what happens? I mean, generally the field of mental health pays very poorly compared to other areas. I mean, psychiatrists, psychologists get paid much less than other areas of MD. So do you go to these students and say, tell you what, we'll give you a scholarship to go to college. We want this many years out of you. We'll pay off your student loans in addition to your salary. I doubt if that's done. But they're probably thinking, why do I want to get lousy pay to do a very tough job that could also cost my life? There's something that should be done with every police officer in the county and every municipality in the county, and that is, you say, we're going to make sure you have crisis intervention training. you're told what to do, how to stand, how to talk when you are encountering someone and you get information on that person's mental illness. If a parent says, listen, my son is out of control, understand he is autistic, he cannot stand to be touched or looked at. If that person right away says, okay, now I know what not to do to provoke that person, how to talk to them, how to do things. Will it work 100% of the time? No. Does it help tremendously? Absolutely. Do we have a requirement that every police officer and paramedic in this county gets training? Nope.
I don't know that.
No, yes. We don't. It's not okay. There. And I've asked the Crisis Intervention International at a convention here a few years ago, and they told me at that time that some chiefs want to have, I never had training, so we don't have to worry about not meeting the standards. And plus, police officers, they're worried about being sued if they do things the wrong way. And if you're some mental health worker, you're called to this crisis scene, that could be violent for them. Look what they did in places like Oregon. They says, well, we're just going to replace police and we'll defund them and we'll have social workers come out. And what the social workers say, nuh-uh, I don't know how to handle a violent situation. It may seem good to someone who thinks that mental health is just an attitude, mental illness is just an attitude, but it is not. It's a brain disease, the severe mental illness. So it's getting the right funding up there so people can be paid a wage to do a tough job there. And also to make sure that the mental health courts are well staffed and the jails too, to have that there should be, let's make these forensic beds. These are going to be different from the jail beds. We're going to be in a jail all day isolated. And many jails, what they'll do is they'll put people in solitary confinement in counties and state prisons, which makes it even worse. One of the things I'd also recommend is talk to the family, Sam. I don't know if county councils ever did this, but to have hearings, say, we want to hear from family members. What's getting in the way now? What is happening? You'll have a lot of people there. Someone will be very upset and angry. That's okay. Listen to the angry moms because they'll give you a lot of real important ideas of what can be done, what are their needs.
No, I know in Allegheny County we have a mental health court. And mm-hmm. I think, you know, from what I hear, Lazard does a great mm-hmm. job there. But it can always be better. And again, I mean, the challenge here, we're talking about a number of things. So on the one hand, we're talking about trying to provide funding. We're trying to provide, funding to try to grow the number of mental health professionals entering the field and going to work there. We're talking about how do we take and increase the number of beds mm-hmm. in the hospitals that are available for these people that are suffering from severe mental illness, okay? We're trying to figure out how do we get every police officer or everyone that could pay first responder that could potentially be called to the scene to deal with some sort of situation, some understanding of how to take and respond, mm-hmm. you know, based upon what they're seeing. And, you know, again, you know, I sit here and I look at these things and I think they're all worthy goals. You know, the struggle is where are we going to find the money to pay for
it? I just told you, the marijuana issue.
Yep. But also I think I worry about the marijuana issue because, you know, as legislators, we get lobbied all the time. And you have these folks that are out there, and they want to be able to self-grow, okay? And so they want us to legalize recreational marijuana and allow them to grow. And as you just shared, we talked about the THC content being so much higher than it was when we were kids. Mm-hmm. You know, and there's also the issues you mentioned about schizophrenia, you know, in young adults, you know, smoking marijuana and this affecting their brains as they're developing. And so, you know, if we legalize recreational marijuana in order to generate revenue to direct toward mental health in this particular situation, you know, do we have any idea how many more folks we may be affected negatively?
Well, I mean, in terms of who developed mental illness?
Yes.
What I said there, you know, 15 to 30% of young adults, you'll see a big increase in psychosis. Psychosis generally costs about $100,000 per person per year. There's a lot we don't know in terms of those costs, too. The court costs, we don't have full information on that. We don't have how much money is out of pocket, too. But look at this, too. So there's some sweet spot. If you do 5% or 4% taxes on those things, maybe too little. If you do 10, 15, 20%, people say, I'll grow it on my own. But here's what happens. With alcohol, we have our state stores. You have other bottle stores, where, you know, the wine and beer. People still make wine at home. People can make beer at home. People can make alcohol at home. But people buy it. And yeah, will there be some who may grow it? Yeah. Do you police their houses? How are you going to do that?
Right.
But if you say, if you're going to use it, understand there's also a social responsibility that goes with that. So this tax is not going to buy the governor a new car or do something like that or build playgrounds. May sound laudable, but it's to do with mental illness. In California, where they said, you know what, we're going to put this money into, we're going to give it back to communities, like 80% to communities and 20% they can use for youth programs. It didn't happen. The youth programs didn't happen. And those 80% of those communities use it to pay other municipal bills. It didn't go for treatment of the problem. Massive amount of money. So if they're saying the same thing in the state, says, well, listen, if these problems are going to grow, pay for the problems that grow out of this. Don't take it here, cause more problems, and put the money somewhere else. That's where I think is a cause. Now, there's other issues too. And there's, I think the state should do a more careful audit in Allegheny County. We want to know every dollar. Because if you find out, yeah, we're spending $300 million, but the problem is really $1.2 billion, mm-hmm. what can we do? And that's accountability for the dollars. If it's just feel-good programs or things that are not making a difference for severe mental illness, because that's where your biggest cost per person is, then you got to make some changes there too in terms of efficiency and accountability for those dollars.
Well, folks, you're hearing it directly from a professional, someone who knows, you know, Dr. Tim Murphy, former congressman and former state legislator here in the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania. And Tim, I want to thank you for coming in to the show today and explaining to our listeners, or just giving them just a brief, you know, touch or explanation of the problem that we're facing and what a potential mm-hmm. solution or way to take and gain the funding to be able to address some of these issues is.
Well, that's one of those things. I would mention too, I have a website, drtimmurphy.com. That's Dr. Tim Murphy, T-I-M-M-U-R-P-H-Y, drtimmurphy.com. So there I put some of my podcasts, I put some of my blogs and other information, and people can get other information on some of these issues. Even though I've been out of the Congress for a while, I have not let up in terms of my advocacy for these problems with mental illness for the millions and millions of families in our nation and the millions of families in our Commonwealth. They need help. And we know that we can make a difference if the care gets to them.
Well, we look forward to working with you and just try to see what we can do around this issue. It's certainly something that's not been going away. It's certainly also something that touches so many families mm-hmm. you hear in Allegheny County, across the Commonwealth, and, you know, dare I say it, across the entire country. That's so right. Whatever we can do, please, we would love to have you back, learn more, and you know, I will try to get more information about Allegheny County, and perhaps we can have a further conversation about that and what we could probably do here at home mm-hmm. you know, in the near future.
Thank you. Please do that.
Well, thank you for having us. Thank you for joining us. I really appreciate it. So, John, yeah. You know, what are your thoughts on the subject here? Putting you on the spot. No, just as I think everybody knows somebody it's been touched in some form by, you know, depression, anxiety, you know, mental illness. And I think folks are always looking for, where do we turn?
Yeah.
Right? And, you know, so it's always a question. And Tim, you know, when we're talking about, you know, where do folks turn? If what's your best advice for somebody right now that has somebody in their family that's having troubles? What would you suggest that they do?
Certainly, if it's suicide, the suicide hotline is 988. But also,
what's the suicide hotline?
988.
Okay.
But also to contact the community mental health centers. There's clinics from Catholic Charities and the free clinics there. If you belong to a church, contact your clergy. About 40% of people with mental health issues go to clergy. Clergy aren't necessarily fully trained in a lot of the severe mental illness. Only about 15% feel they know what to do. But conversely, a lot of people who are psychologists, they may turn to them, but a lot of them don't know how to deal with severe mental illness. The reason clergy is so important too is study after study after study shows that those who regularly attend religious services have a much lower rate of depression and anxiety, suicide threats, suicide attempts, suicide deaths, and PTSD. Healing is much better. That's extremely important. Let's make sure we talk about that and the value of faith in this whole process too. But to understand there's a lot of waiting lists, but don't give up. Please keep trying to find people who are there. I know that getting someone into a hospital bed is really tough, but you got to keep trying. And here's what's important in a program like this. I ask people to let their government officials know. It's not just to the president or Congress or senator. It isn't just your state legislator. It's to you too. People in the county and the municipal level. Now, many times they'll shrug their shoulders and say, I don't know what to do. And my point is, will you please talk to each other and understand that by not doing anything, the cost of not caring is more, mm-hmm. But keep reaching out.
No, I appreciate that. I'm sure our listeners do as well. I mean, I have, in my family, how they've just much like you're talking about mental health, many of us have also been touched by the opioid epidemic. Mm. You know, and I, you know, had a family member who, you know, was basically an addict and was smoking, you know, crack. And I remember the helplessness I felt as I drove from one hospital to another, you know, trying to get him admitted to some sort of rehab facility, only to be turned down, you know, place after place after place because beds weren't available.
Right.
So, you know, I know firsthand how frustrating and how helpless that folks feel. But, you know, again, to your point, please don't give up. There are resources available, you know, and Tim, you did a great job explaining what some of those were, you know, whether it was a suicide hotline, whether it was the clergy, some of the others. Folks, you know, please, this is an important topic. I know we've deviated from what we normally talk about, which is politics, but I hope you found this show extremely enlightening and worthwhile. I know that I always enjoy talking to Congressman Murphy and learning more about this issue and what we can do, because it's always enlightening. You know, we talk about the cost of things, and sometimes the cost of doing nothing is actually much more expensive than the cost of doing something. So I think things do need to get done, and government certainly has money. If we can take and spend hundreds of billion dollars on windmills and solar panels from China, I think we can try to provide mental health care for some of the residents of this country who are most in need of it. So please, you know, let us know what you think, and let us know how we can help. So until next week, this is Sam DeMarco for the Elephant in the Room signing off. Look forward to seeing you next week. I'm going to take a well-needed rest after that dinner we had and then gear up for the fall campaign to try to get some representatives who will address some of the things that Congressman Murphy talked about here today elected to office. So until next week, this is Sam DeMarco and the Elephant in the Room on WJAS 1320 AM and Talk 99.1 FM signing off. Have a great weekend.